Section 18 of Notes on Democracy by H. L. Mencken. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Part 2, Chapter 9, Footnote on Lame Ducks. Faguette makes no mention of one of the curious and unpleasant byproducts of democracy, of great potency for evil in both England and the United States. Perhaps for some unknown reason it is less a nuisance in France. I allude to the sinister activity of professional politicians who, in the eternal struggle for office and its rewards, have suffered crushing defeats and are full of rage and bitterness. All politics under democracy resolves itself into a series of dynastic questions. The objective is always the job, not the principle. The defeated candidate commonly takes his failure very badly, for it leaves him stripped bare. In most cases, his fellow professionals take pity on him and put him into some more or less gaudy appointive office to preserve his livelihood and save his face. The federal commissions that harass the land are full of such lame ducks, and they are not unknown on the federal bench. But now and then there appears one whose wounds are too painful to be assuaged by such devices, or for whom no suitable office can be found. This majestic victim not infrequently seeks surcease by a sort of running amok. That is to say, he turns what remains of his influence with the mob into a weapon against the nation as a whole, and becomes a chronic maker of trouble. The names of Burr, Clay, Calhoun, Douglas, Blaine, Greeley, Fremont, Roosevelt, and Bryan will occur to every attentive student of American history. There have been many similar warlocks on lower levels. They are familiar in the politics of every American county. Clay, like Bryan before him, was three times a candidate for the presidency. Defeated in 1824, 1832, and 1840, he turned his back upon democracy and became the first public agent and attorney for what are now called the interests. When he died, he was the darling of the Mellons, Morgans, and Charlie Schwabs of his time. He believed in centralization and in the blessings of a protective tariff. These blessings the American people still enjoy. Calhoun, deprived of the golden plum by an unappreciative country, went even further. He seems to have come to the conclusion that its crime made it deserve capital punishment. At all events, he threw his strength into the plan to break up the Union. The doctrine of nullification owed more to him than it owed to any other politician, and after 1832, when his hopes of getting into the White House were finally extinguished, he devoted himself wholeheartedly to preparing the way for the Civil War. He was more to blame for that war, in all probability, than any other man. But if he had succeeded Jackson, the chances are that he would have sung a far less bellicose tune. The case of Burr is so plain that it is even got into the school history books. If he had beaten Jefferson in 1800, there would have been no duel with Hamilton, no conspiracy with Blennerhassett, no trial for treason, and no long exile and venomous repining. Burr was an able man, as politicians go under democracy, and the young republic stood in great need of his peculiar talents. But his failure to succeed Adams made a misanthrope of him, and his misanthropy was vented upon his country, and more than once brought it to the verge of disaster. There have been others like him in our own time: Blaine, Fremont, Hancock, Roosevelt, Bryan. If Blaine had been elected in 1876, he would have ceased to wave the bloody shirt. As it was, he was still waving it recklessly and obscenely in 1884. No man labored more assiduously to keep alive the hatreds flowing out of the Civil War. His whole life was poisoned by his failure to reach the White House, and his dreadful cramps and rages led him into a long succession of obviously antisocial acts. Roosevelt went the same route. His debacle in 1912 converted him into a sort of political killer, and until the end of his life he was constantly on the warpath, looking for heads to crack. The outbreak of the World War in 1914 brought him great embarrassment, for he had been the most ardent American exponent, for years past, of what was then generally regarded as the German scheme of things. For a few weeks he was irresolute, and seemed likely to stick to his guns, but then, perceiving a chance to annoy and damage his successful enemy, Wilson, he swallowed the conviction of a lifetime and took the other side. That his ensuing uproars had evil effects must be manifest. Regardless of the consequences, either at home or abroad, he kept on arousing the mob against Wilson, and in the end he helped more than any other man to force the United States into the war. His aim, it quickly appeared, was to turn the situation to his own advantage. He made desperate and shameless efforts to get a high military command at the front, a post for which he was plainly unfitted. When Wilson, still smarting from his attack, vetoed this scheme, he broke into fresh rages, and the rest of his life was more pathological than political. The fruits of his reckless demagogy are still with us. Bryan was even worse. His third defeat in 1908 convinced even so vain a fellow that the White House was beyond his reach, and so he consecrated himself to reprisals upon those who had kept him out of it. He saw very clearly who they were, the more intelligent minority of his countrymen. It was their unanimous opposition that had thrice thrown the balance against him. Well, he would now make them infamous. He would raise the mob, which still admired him, against everything they regarded as sound sense and intellectual decency. He would post them as sworn foes to all true virtue and true religion, and try, if possible, to put them down by law. There ensued his frenzied campaign against the teaching of evolution, perhaps the most gross attack upon human dignity and decorum ever made by a politician, even under democracy, in modern times. Those who regarded him, in his last years, as a mere religious fanatic were far in error. It was not fanaticism that moved him, but hatred. He was an ambulant boil, as anyone could see who encountered him face to face. His theological ideas were actually very vague. He was quite unable to defend them competently under Clarence Darrow's cross-examination. What moved him was simply his colossal lust for revenge upon those he held to be responsible for his downfall as a politician. He wanted to hurt them, proscribe them, if possible, destroy them. To that end, he was willing to sacrifice everything else, including the public tranquility and the whole system of public education. He passed out of life at last at a temperature of 110 degrees, his eyes rolling horribly toward 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest and its leaky copper roof. In the suffering South, his fever lives after him. The damage he did was greater than that done by Sherman's army. Countries under the hoof of despotism escape such lamentable exhibitions of human frailty. Unsuccessful aspirants for the crown are either butchered out of hand or exiled to Paris, where tertiary lieus quickly disposes of them. The crown prince, of course, has his secret thoughts, and no doubt they are sometimes homicidal, but he is forced by etiquette to keep them to himself, and so the people are not annoyed and injured by them. He cannot go about praying publicly that the king, his father, come down with endocarditis, nor can he denounce the old gentleman as an idiot and advocate his confinement in a maison de santé. Everyone, of course, knows what his hopes and yearnings are, but no one has to listen to them. If he voices them at all, it is only to friendly and discreet members of the diplomatic corps and to the ladies of the half and quarter words. Under democracy, they are bellowed from every stump. End of section 18.